Parshas Maaseh, the Torah discusses the Gerul, the way they divided Eretz Yisrael, to the Shvatim. Torah says, "This Nachal Temes Aretz Begerul, you shall divide Eretz Yisrael with a Gerul, with a lottery." The first time this was mentioned actually was several Parshias ago in Parshas Pinchas. The Torah says, "Ach Begerul Yechalekas Aretz." Again, you shall divide Eretz Yisrael via Gerul. There are about a half dozen places in Tanakh where Gerul is mentioned by the Torah. First one is Parshas Achrimos in the Avodah of Yom Kippur. The Torah says one of the karbanos was a pair of seirim. You take two seirim, two goats, and it says V'nasan Aaron al shnei seirim garolos. You should put garolos on the. Put garolos on the two seirim, garol echad l'Hashem, garol echad l'Azazel, and you choose which seir goes l'Hashem, which was offered in the Beis Hamikdash, and which was thrown off the mountain in Azazel. You choose that via a garol. There was another garol. Some of the garolos are a little bit less known. There was a garol in the beginning of Sefer Yoshua. There was a garol where the Jews lost a battle, and it was understood that the reason for that was that someone had done an avera. Someone had been moel in the cherem. Someone had violated the cherem. So it says that Hashem told him somebody was guilty, but Hashem would not say who. Chazal explained that Hashem said, "I don't tell lashon hara. I don't inform on people. So you figure out yourself who it was." So they did a gerul. The gerul was first they separated the shvatim. They chose different through a gerul. They decided which shevet it was. Then they figured out which family within the Shevet, and then within the Shevet, they figured out which person it was. It turned out it was Achan who had violated the Cherem, and he eventually was executed. Yeshua asked him to please confess and admit what he had done. He did so, and he was executed. We have a famous Gerul, of course, in Purim, done by Haman in Russia. The Torah says, Megillah says, Hipil Pur Hu HaGerul, and he picked the day of the 13th of Adar to destroy the Jews. And we have a Gerul of Yonah. We read on Yom Kippur, we read the story of Yonah. It says there was a terrible storm, and the sailors wanted to figure out what was the problem, why was there such a storm. So it says that they, let's cast lots, we'll figure out who it was, and sure enough, the Gerul fell on Yonah. They asked Yonah, "Explain to us what's going on. You know, why are you the one the Gerul is singling out?" Yonah explained he was running away from Hashem, and eventually they threw him overboard. And Yonah himself said, "Take me and throw me overboard." They did. They threw him overboard, and the storm stopped. And the sailors were very, very impressed, very, very shaken by this event. These are perhaps the half dozen famous accounts, more or less famous accounts, of Gerul and Tanakh. There's one other one about the Gevonim. It says that they have to choose. The Gevonim wanted revenge against Shaul's family. It was a terrible famine, and Hashem said it was because they had mistreated the Gevonim. So they asked the Gevonim, what do they want? The Gevonim said, "We want blood. We want revenge against Shaul's family." So they killed seven members of Shaul's family, and they were chosen again through some kind of Gerul process. So these are the six or seven examples of Gerul and Tanakh. So there are basically two questions I want to discuss about Gerul. First question is, what is a Gerul? Does a Gerul have any theological significance? Is there assumed to be any special siyata d'shmaya, or is it just an agreement among people to decide what to do? Or do we impute any theological significance to it? And second, halacha l'maisa, are we allowed to use a Gerul to make such life and death decisions as they made for Yonah, or even other decisions? Is a person allowed to conduct his life? You know, can you flip a coin to decide who goes first and who receives the first kickoff in a football game, to decide who gets property? What are the halachas involved in using a Gerul? As we discussed earlier, gambling is a separate topic. Gambling itself, the various possibly surim involved in gambling, is a whole separate topic. We're not going to get into that. I want to just discuss other issues involved in Gerul, other halachic issues involved in making decisions and trying to either learn the future or make decisions based on a Gerul. So, the first question in terms of what is the theological significance of a Gerul. So on the one hand, we have these half dozen cases in the Torah of Gerul. On the other hand, as the post can point out, it's difficult to know how much we can infer from this, because these were many of these, some of these cases were done by non-Jews. Haman, obviously, we're not going to learn halachas from him, and even Yonah, the people doing the garal were not Jews. On the other hand, they were clearly upright people. They became, according to Chazal, they became Gerim afterwards. Anyway, they seem to have been God-fearing and morally upstanding people. They were very reluctant to kill Yonah. There's some debate how much we can learn from those. On the other hand, the garal of this week's Pasha, of the Chalukas Haaretz, the division of Eretz Israel, was a direct command from God. The garal of the Shnei Seirim, of Yom Kippur, also was a commandment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this, as we'll discuss, the postmodern are going to debate as to how much we can really learn from these garalos. How far can we take them? Do we say these were just special tibuyim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and can't be generalized? Other cases or not, as we see, poskim come down on very different sides, on very different sides of this question. Yes, so we learned Kibbutz Abayim, the story you're referring to. The Gemara says that we see how meticulous, how careful he was. Because, yes, so that is true. We do learn halachas from non-Jews, and that is true. And as I mentioned, some poskim do say we can learn from these sailors of Yom, especially if you see that there are people who do the right thing. Yes, I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility of learning from non-Jews. Oh, you're right.
Sisera's mother.
What does it say we learned from her?
She was waiting for her son to come back from the
right.
So we're the shofar also there, don't we?
Oh, right. You're right. The famous drasha that beyond the kolos, the 9 kolos or 30 kolos mandated by Chazal, we have 100. We learn from her cries. Yeah, so the rest of there certainly are examples scattered throughout Gemara of learning from non-Jews. Yeah, and I agree that's a tricky topic. I don't have too much to say about this right now, but it's not so simple. I agree sometimes we don't, and we'll elaborate on this a little bit as we go on. So we begin with a tshuva of the Gaonim. Very, very, very strange, very cryptic comment to the Gaonim. So strange, many Acharon comment that it just seems like a bizarre thing to say. Some of them even say we don't even know if it's authentic. But the Gaonim are talking about dividing property by a garel. If you have some assets, you have to make some decision, Chazon Mishpat, civil law type of decision, you do a garel and you follow the garel. And then the Gaonim say, Ein Rishus L'Adam in Yisrael Labra HaGarel, no Jew has the right to go against the authority of the Garel. Shein HaGarel Al Pi Shamayim. Why not? Because Garel is assumed to reflect the will of Hashem. Shenemar Al Pi HaGarel Techalik Haaretz. His source is the fact that the division of Eretz Yisrael was commanded to be done by a Garel. And then he adds, V'Hover El HaGarel K'Hover El HaSeres HaDibris. Someone who violates a Garel, who flouts the decision of a garel is like someone who violates the Aseret HaDibros. A very bizarre, very, very hard to understand statement. Aseret HaDibros. And many Acharim indeed said that they don't understand this, where does this come from? But anyway, this comment of the Gaonim is one of our earliest, most authoritative sources for the authority of a garel. That the garel is something very serious, and it carries weight, and the makor is from the garel of the Torah, and you have to follow the garel. We also have a very curious comment of Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam. Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam, the Rambam's one famous son, was a very curious character. On the one hand, he shared much of his father's philosophical, skeptical orientation. He was a great warrior in his father's cause, defending philosophy, defending science against his opponents. So on the one hand, we think of him as a kind of very modern, very, very skeptical figure sometimes. On the other hand, he also, perhaps unlike his father, he also did follow some of the mystical traditions that were common in his time, some of the Islamic traditions. But here he has a tshuva. Someone asked him, not sure what the question was, but somebody asked him, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, our master, you teach us, educate us. Hagarolos Mahim. What exactly are garolos? How do you do them? People say, let's do a garol. What is this all about? What are the rules? What are the parameters of a garol? So Rabbi Avraham answered, a garol in Arabic is called Al-Kara. I don't know what that is. He said you do it either with slips of paper, tickets that have names on them, or with luchas, cards, or little little pieces of board or something. And he writes, there's some way, some ill-understood way that they can reveal hidden things. We don't understand it, he says. We don't have a scientific explanation for it. We can't give a rational explanation for how a Gara works. But there's something real going on here. Why he thought this, whether he felt that he doesn't give any explanation of where he got this from, but he says the Garo is a legitimate thing, we don't fully understand it, but a Garo really does have some power to reveal hidden knowledge. Okay, that's where we have Ram Ben Aramba. In terms of the poskim, in terms of the Achronim, the most famous tshuva of Garo is a long, intricate tshuva of the Chavos Yar, about the 18th century. The Chavos Yar had a case, he says, gives you a lot of graphic detail, he says there was a group of people, students of his, a chabur of his, he says, that they once on Purim, he says, they were drinking on Purim, and then the entertainment was they made a Garo. They had some very expensive item, they had a silver cup inlaid with gold, and they were going to raffle it off. I don't know if the proceeds were going to tzedakah or it was just entertainment, they were just a game among themselves, but everyone gave one Reichsthaler, a coin, common coin at that time, I don't know how much it was worth. And the way the Garo was done, he says, he gives you all the details, there were two boxes. In one box, they put 12 pieces of paper with the names of the 12 participants. In the other box, they were supposed to put 12 pieces of paper, and 11 would be blank, and one would say the word Mazel Tov on it, and they would pick out pairs, one from each box. Whichever name would come out at the same time as the Mazel Tov would get this expensive goblet. Now, the obvious question here is, why do they do such a convoluted system? If any of us would do a Garo, we would just say, one box, 12 names, first name you pick out is the winner. Whatever reason they didn't want to do this, they did this more intricate, more elaborate system.
Not how they did it,
Good point. Right. That point to Chazal. Chazal gives the details of the Gara of Eretz Yisrael. And it does say that they would have divisions of the land, 12 papers with the 12 things, with the division of the plots of land, and 12 shvatim, they would match each one. They wouldn't just say, Reuven, let's pick one for you. Shimon, let's pick one for you. They would actually have two boxes. So, in all likelihood, that's true, although he doesn't mention that. I don't think he mentions it explicitly, but in all likelihood, that's a good point. That's probably why they did it. Now, you can ask me just why Chazal did it that way, but there might be explanations for that, too. I'm not going to get into all the midrashim about the Garo of the Arts. But in any event, this was how they did it, probably based on that precedent. And so what happened was, there were a number of things that went wrong with this Garo. On the first drawing, the Mazel Tov came out on the second drawing. Someone thought that was too early. I'm not sure why. There were 12 of them. I mean, the second one is not a particularly unlikely occurrence, but somebody was a little surprised. So he checked the boxes. He found they only put 11 papers in, 10 blank and one Mazel Tov. There was one short. So the winner said, so what? I didn't have any unfair advantage, whether 11, 10. It's true, it wasn't exactly parallel to the Lucas. It was done, they violated the protocol, but not in any way that gave me an advantage. So what? Whether it was done deliberately, whether it was done by accident, who cares? It didn't affect anybody's relative chances.
Number 12 could have been that.
I'm sorry?
Number 12 could have been number 2.
Number
12 guy who wasn't included.
All the names were included. The one box had 12. The box that had the blank papers and the Mazel Tov only had 11 10 blank papers and one Mazel Tov. So, all right, the Chavos Yar said, nope, you violated the technical protocols of the Garo. The Garo is dismissed. You have to do it again. So they did it again. They did a second round. This time, the sixth drawing was the winner. Then someone again, for some reason, checked the boxes, and this time he found that one of the 12 participants, his name was not submitted into the box. So again, the guy who won said like this. He turned to the other 10 people, not the guy whose name was missed, he turned to the other 10 people and said, look, the fact that his name wasn't there, if anything, improved your chances slightly. So you have no reason to complain. This guy, his name wasn't there, I'll settle with him. I'll give him, I'll split it with him, I'll give him, I'll pay him off. I'll take care of him. And for you, why should you complain? Your chances weren't diminished by his name not being there. Chavos Yar again said, nope. The rules were not followed strictly, precisely. Garl is dismissed and has to be done again. And the Chavos Yar says, the reason he passes this way, and here he gets to the core of the matter, reason he paskins this way, he says, is that even though Al-Pisekhel, he says he wouldn't think there's any objection, but he says if there's a toast, then the garul is invalid. He says garul is a very important and very serious procedure. And the Torah, he says, and Levim, and the two of them, we discuss the various examples of the Torah, of the Yom Kippur and the Aretz, Levim, the story of the Gevonim, the story of Achan, I forgot actually, one of the other stories of the Garul Tanakh is the story of Shaul and Yonas. And it says again, Shaul got a message during a battle from Hashem not to pursue the enemy because he wasn't going to win. He realized it was because there was some Avera. Turned out that there had been a Cherem, and Shaul had said, nobody can eat today until we win. And his own son, Yonason, had tasted some flash. He was famished and weary, and he tasted some flash. He didn't realize it was a Cherem. So again, they did a Garul test to find out who the guilty person was. First they put Klal Yisrael on one side, and Shaul and Yonas on the other side. The Garul fell on them too. Then they put Shaul on one side, Yonas on the other side. The Garul pointed to Yonason. It says Yonason was going to get killed. It says, Beyiftu Amas Yonason Balombes. But again, they used the Garul to determine who the guilty person was. So again, the Chavos Yair says, Betara, Benevim, and Shmuel, in Yeshua, in Ksuvim, we have Yonah, we have the Gilas Esther. He says, we have all these examples of Garul. And he says, even the non-Jews, he says, he has no problem learning from non-Jews. He says, Yana, Hamana Rasha, he says, all these examples of Garul. He says, the Garul is powerful. The Garul has, again, like Rabbi Avraham and Aram says, the Garul has some kind of powerful validity that we don't understand. It doesn't say whether we understand it or not, but it has some kind of authority that's given to it, that the Torah tells us about. That's only if the protocols are followed precisely, if the recipes are followed exactly. I don't know if he means that there's a set recipe that you have to follow, or he means at least you have to go according to whatever you made up, and you can't deviate from your agreement. But whatever it is, the Garul works, but only if it's done kahogan. Then it has divine providence, hashgacha elyona, that it's going to work. If the Garul is done improperly, then it's not valid. So, therefore, any mistake that was made, even if it didn't give any specific party or parties unfair advantage, the Garul has to be dismissed, and we don't follow it.
Well, in the two examples that you gave, even though it doesn't give any unfair advantage,
yes,
it mathematically it's different. It's a different game, in both cases. I mean, if you're talking about Garul having some
right, each drawing and the odds of when which drawing is going to win, you know, there certainly are differences in how it's.
It's an absolutely different game if you take one paper out or you take one name.
Okay, yeah. In other words, like your point is, I don't know if you would have said this if they would have misspelled somebody's name. I don't know if that would have made a difference because that's not a different game. That's the same game, the misspelling of one of the names. But in this case, when there are different numbers of papers and the right. Odds and the probabilities are different, that was enough of a difference, he felt, to invalidate the Garul.
If we say that if there is like some mistake in the Quran, then there's like no divine providence in it. So we also have the concept of Allah, there's no such thing as Allah. So then what is it if there's no divine
providence? So that's a good question. The Chavos Yair himself uses a different language. He says, at one point when he's trying to explain this problem, he says, Mati kol chad l'meimar, each participant can claim, anyone who didn't win can claim, Ilu nasa garul kahogan, had it been done properly, hayakayem lishati al pi mazli, either based on luck, or al pi tfilasi. He kind of hedges his bet, sheitan liatzlacha b'chal iskai. Either my tfilah would have been more effective, that why exactly your tfilah should be more effective if the garul is done one way or another, I don't understand, or mazli. Whether mazel is plays a role or not is a tough topic. On the one hand, as Rishon already discussed, there's contradictions in the Gemara. On the one hand, the Gemara says ain mazel in Israel. On the other hand, the Gemara says bani chayim zechusa, the bani chayim is only love artelian mazel. So there are different perspectives on all this. Again, I'm not prepared to get, you know, I don't know enough about Mazel on the tip of my tongue what Chazal and Rishonim say about it. But that is an important question too, whether the issue is Mazel or the issue is some other kind of process. But a good point, yes. But I don't have enough to say about it off the cuff. So we'll turn now to, and there are others who disagree with this Chavos Yair. There are other later posts who say Garul is just an agreement. It's just a time David Alevi, particularly, she was a Seilach HaRav last century. argues very strongly against this. He says all of Habasyar's arguments are uncompelling, unpersuasive. Again, like we discussed earlier, the Raya from the Gur, the Torah, that's different because that was Al Pi Hashem, that was a special Rashah. We don't know that every Gur made by any particular Jewish person that affirms him automatically has this divine authority. He feels very strongly that an ordinary Gur is nothing more than a coin toss at a football game, is nothing more than an agreement among the participants. They have no special theological significance. The shaila he was talking about was there was a certain shul that was trying to decide how to distribute the aliyahs. So one method obviously was the common one of selling them, auctions. Some people didn't want that, and an alternate system that was proposed was Gur. And some people opposed the Gur. Some people felt the Gur is Jewish, it's superstitious. Some people didn't like the idea of a Gur. So the Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, he discusses whether among the things he discusses is whether the Gur really has theological impact or not. He argues very strongly that it does not. In other words, if it would, then it would be a strong argument in favor of adopting it, because it's a divinely mandated procedure. But if it's just a personal agreement that the parties involved agree to settle their dispute by a girl, they have the right to do it, he says, it's not us, sir, but then it has no special validity. Then he says you have to have a solid majority vote in favor of doing it. If it would be something which has a makar in the Torah, maybe it could be imposed on the community by anybody. But he comes out that not like the Tavasiyar, he doesn't like the Tavasiyar, he says he has no special divine mandate, it's just a handy method to resolve difficulties, and only people agree to do it. If not, it has no special significance. There are a number of actual halakhic problems involved with the Gurl. The main one is the idea of Tamim Tiyeh Hashem Elokecha. The Torah has, of course, many different prohibitions against different kinds of magic, sorcery, necromancy, astrology, all kinds of magical ways to take shortcuts against HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, against nature. And there's a great deal of debate in the Gemara, in the Mishonim, in the Achronim, how to understand what exactly all the different laws of the Torah are, what is Ov, what is Yidoni, what is exactly the history of astrology, and so on and so forth. But in general, one of the psukim that always gets quoted is the pasuk of Tamim Tiyeh Hashem Elokecha, that a general mitzvah say to keep faith with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be tamim. Not what that exactly means is a very difficult topic. Most people understand that when it comes simply to science, there's no issue. When it comes to predicting the weather via supercomputer models, or predicting or trying to get an edge in the stock market through mathematical modeling, or even genetic testing to avoid diseases, most people understand that there's no violation of Tamim Tiyeh. As long as Hashem made the world for us to live in, and any derech hateva, any natural method we have for learning about the future through scientific methods, there's nothing wrong with that. There are, I believe, some very conservative thinkers who did believe that some of these things are violations of Tamim Tiyeh, like maybe genetic testing perhaps, or other things. But I think the mainstream approach is that anything which is derech hateva, there is absolutely nothing wrong with. It's generally understood, I believe, that Tamim Tiyeh refers to supernatural methods of gaming the system by gaining a magical, supernatural edge over nature, over HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. In particular, Tosis brings a Sifri. We don't actually have this in our text of a Sifri, but Tosis brings a Sifri. The Sifri says, Minayin Shein Sholem B'Garolos. How do we know that we're not allowed to consult Sholem, to ask, to consult a Garol? Shenemar Tamim Tiyeh. The Torah says Tamim Tiyeh, you shouldn't again try to gain these mystical edges against the system. And Tosis goes on to say that astrology also is the same idea, so it's also included in Tamim Tiyeh. But for our purposes, Tosis claims he has a Sifri that says that consulting a Garol is a violation of the mitzvah say of Tamim Tiyeh and Hashem Elokecha.
You can also think that it doesn't work. It's just nourishkeit.
Yeah. So as I discussed with some of the guys, there is an extensive and very confusing discussion in the postman in general about the relationship of all the magic the Torah prohibited and the question of whether they work or not. So, for example, the Ben Ezra says, talking about Ov and Yidoni, different kinds of sorcery, the Ben Ezra says, empty-headed people ask, he says, if these things weren't true, why the Torah prohibit them? So these empty-headed people, he says, think that all the things the Torah prohibited are true. The Ben Ezra says, I say just the opposite. The Torah only forbids things that don't work, not things that do work. And he says, Avodah Zarah is the greatest example. Avodah Zarah doesn't work, yet the Torah spends so much time and energy forbidding it.
there were star readers. I mean, in the Mitzrayim, Pharaoh had a whole fleet of people that were able to do match up until the point they could do the star system as well.
Right. So I discussed this in my shiurim with the camp, but there is extensive debate about that. So one of the primary sources of that is the Rashba. In the Rashba's time, in the early 14th century, there was a great controversy over a certain magical procedure that was done for medical therapeutic reasons. It involved drawing a picture of a lion, possibly offering some incense and other mystic rituals. It was believed to be very effective to cure certain diseases. And there was a great halakhic debate about whether this was mutter or not. So the Rashba mentioned that the rabbi he was corresponding with said, it's usur. And it's usur, even though it works, because it works. That's why it's usur, because everything in the Torah works, like you're saying, like examples of the Torah, and yet they're usur anyway. In other words, this rabbi held like the people of Ezra calls the empty-headed people. This is the sheet of this rabbi. The Rashba says, you know, this is what you assume he says, but the Rambam says just the opposite. The Rambam famously spends a lot of time saying that all or almost all the magical things the Torah talks about are all nonsense and all ridiculous. So the Rashba, in his great humility, the Rashba says, and he tells his correspondent, what you're saying is not so simple. The Rambam disagrees. However, the Rashba says, I'm not great enough, I'm not smart enough, he says, to resolve this dispute between you and the Rambam. He says, if you ask me, I think that your position, the one you're mentioning, is more probable, more persuasive than the Rambam's. Because one of the arguments he makes is what you said. The Torah seems to have certain descriptions of magic, both the Khartoum of Mitzrayim is one. The fact that they did, as you said, the first two makas, Dum Tzardeya, and they did a stick into a snake and that, and they only were foiled at Kenan, but they could do something. The other example they give is the story of the witch, Shaul and the witch, at Ein Dar, which apparently raised the spirit of Shmuel. The Rambam has terutzim for this. I don't know enough time to get into all the discussion, but the Rambam and his followers do have terutzim. Basically, they say that they were frauds. They were like magicians today. They used sleight of hand and quick movements and smoke and mirrors. And the case of Shaul and the witch, they say it was a kind of ventriloquism. She had a little guy hiding in a box who would cast his voice and make it sound like they didn't see anybody. They just had voices. The Rambam makes it
true in the end.
Sorry?
Even though it's true,
the fact is she got everything right. The woman in the case of Shaul and the witch, she did predict very accurately what happened in the battle. And the Gaonim, the Radak brings the Gaonim with the ones who said that it was all fraud. How did she know? She guessed. She read the newspaper. She saw what was going on. She saw that the Plishtim outnumbered the Jews. She saw the morale of the Jews was terrible. She made it the same way the magicians today, you know, can convince you that they know the truth by shrewd guesses, by learning things from you, and they say things often vague enough that they can come out true. Whatever happens, you can argue about how persuasive this is or not, but in any event, this is an old machlok to be shown him whether the things that the Torah prohibited are true or false. And regarding your point, part of the machlok itself is, what did the Torah asur? Some Rishonim said the Torah only asur those things which have some element of truth, as the Rashba's friend explains, because the only things that have a power over people, that might persuade people, that might be seductive to people, are only things that have some truth. If they were just ridiculous, it wouldn't be such a Yetzer Hara. People wouldn't be doing it all the time. Not sure what he says about Avodah Zarah, but he says that was the position of some people, and the Rambam said just the opposite. It's the more cynical view. People do follow things which have no truth at all to them. And the Rambam actually seems to say just the opposite. The Rambam seems to say that anything is true, Chazal have a statement, Kol she'yesh b'mishum refuah, ein b'mishum darchei amori, anything that actually has therapeutic benefit is not awesome. So some Rishonim seem to learn, anything that actually works, we may not understand how, we may not have a good scientific theory of how, but if empirical evidence shows that it works, it's not awesome. It's just the opposite. The Torah only asks things that don't work, not things that do work. So with regard to the Garo, I don't know if anyone really gets into the question of if you have a particular Garo procedure which is demonstrably reliable or demonstrably unreliable, not sure how that changes anything, but in any event, Tosis B'Shem L'Sifri says that Garo is forbidden, it violates Talmud Tiyah, and the Shulchan Aruch passes this way. The Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to consult a Garo, Ramah explains, because it says, Talmud Tiyah M'Shem L'Kecha. So this Tosfos, this is free, the Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to use a Garel to try to learn about the future.
Is that limited? Shouldn't that be limited to telling the future through a Garel, not deciding
so that's the next step I want to discuss. Several Akronim make the point that Rav Schwartz is making. Several Akronim say there's a big difference between trying to learn the future and trying to make a decision. Right? The language of the Sifri, the language of the Shulchan Aruch is, Ein Shalom Gavrolas, you can't ask a question of a Gavrol. And a number of Akronim make this distinction, with more or less clearly, more or less articulately, that the only kind of consulting a Gavrol that's forbidden is if you're actually trying to learn something about the future, not if you're simply trying to resolve an impasse and make a decision. So, Shlomo Kluger brings one example of Garo that was widespread use among the Akronim was, we discussed earlier with the example of selling Elias, or doing a Garo for Elias. One thing that was apparently a very common procedure going back to the early Akronim was, today the common minhag is, and most shuls I've been to is, that when multiple people need to say Kaddish, we usually have, they say Kaddish together. Some shuls don't do that, some shuls have only one person say Kaddish. Certain Kaddishim, but the common custom in most places I've been to is we have multiple Kaddishim. But in shul, you only have one person. Obviously, you have a problem with who says it. Or even in our shuls, only one person davens the Amud. So in Shomre, for example, when they have two Avelim, sometimes they make a second minion outside. But what if you have more than two people? What if you don't have that custom? So what do you do when there are two Avelim, two Chiyuvim? Right, so trying to figure out the past or the future, I think for these purposes, trying to figure out a fact, whether it's past or future, would be in the same category. It might be possible to distinguish between them, but that is a good question, but I think for our purposes, you're actually trying to learn a concrete fact, whether it's past or future. I think that would probably fall into the category of Isser, but we'll keep that in mind. We'll see if we have...
All Christ will conquer this land. They're asking for themselves. We want this land. We have a lot of... Well,
I'm not sure. Okay, we'll discuss some examples in different people in history who may have done that, but I'm not sure if they're not. I'm not sure if they the six examples we gave, none of them were directly predicted in the future. So, Rav Shlomo Kluger says that this Isser is only when you're actually trying to discern. He actually uses the word the future. He doesn't get into the distinction you're making, but he says the example would be, you want to know if somebody's going to live or die, you want to know if you're going to find some lost property or not. That's Tamim Tia. But just to decide, just to resolve a dispute, just to decide and make a decision, he says, that there's no Isser of Tamim Tia. He gives an example of a Garl in Talmud. He says, they used to do the Avodah. They used to have a Gemara Yuma. The Gemara said they had a pious to decide who would do the different Avodahs. That's a Garl. The Garl of the Chalukas Haaretz, he says. And even though he acknowledges the point many Akronim made, that was Al Pi HaDibur, that was because Baruch Hu's express commandment, how would a Kodesh Baruch Hu tell him to do something which is Kishur, which is against the ethos of the Torah? He says, that's no Isser, he says. So the Meili says, do Kaddish to make decisions. So again, he doesn't discuss the middle case you said about a girl in the past, but he says, to decide the future is Usser, to make a decision about how to divide scarce resources with Mutter, and he doesn't explicitly discuss this question about deciding the past.
First of all, the way they decided the Avodah, that's like a broad definition of girl, because that wasn't necessarily like they had names. That was
counting,
like, yeah, they go around in circles. Like,
that's true. That's true. But I think he's assuming it's the same idea. It's like making a game of chance to decide something. I think he's assuming. Right. I think he's assuming it's all. You're right. One could distinguish. But I think.
Like, would also be considered.
I think so. I think according to him, I think he would say that. Yeah.
Also, aren't there are cases where the Torah seems to allow things that are prohibited in other cases. Like, people like the Kruvim, like on the Aram, there seems to be a Buddha's Aram, and yet the Torah seems to say that that's allowed.
It's also a big topic, so... On one level, we have the notion of Harashah. The famous example Imara talks about is Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel. It says Eliyahu, when he made his great demonstration in the Nevi'i Habal, it says he brought Karbanos on Har HaKarmel, outside the Beis HaMikdash, outside the Mishkan. So, outside the Beis HaMikdash. So, Chazal say that was clearly Osir. That's normally that's a grave Isir. B'shkutei Chutz is an Isir. But because of the need to do it, to make the Kiddush Hashem, to make his public demonstration, Navi has the right to temporarily, on a short-term basis, Navi can do a harasha. And you're giving examples, perhaps, of permanent mitzvahs. There's a famous Kabbalistic doctrine, the Ramban goes even further, there's a famous Kabbalistic idea, the Sar Lazazel. So the Ramban, based on Kabbalistic sources, the Ramban says that Tzara Lazazel is sort of a bribe to the devil, basically, to the Satan, the Sitra Achra, even though it sounds like, that really sounds like a Buddha's offering gifts or bribes to a foreign force and shouldn't leave you alone. It really sounds like a bizarre, and the Ramban tries very hard to explain why it's not. So yes, you're giving a kind of a more basic, more Alpi Nigla. The Gemara says that the crew of him, it says the Goyim attacked us, they criticized us for being idol worshippers just like them because we have things that look like a bizarre. But the proof of man, I would say, is not as bad, because even though it looks like a Vodazara, we really don't consider it a Vodazara, we have a different interpretation of it. In general, the question of whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to do things or does things himself, which would actually be Yisurim, I mean, again, the Gemara does in various places assume that Hashem would not do things or not tell us to do things that are... Oh, so for example, I mentioned earlier that Achan says Hashem said someone has sinned, he wouldn't say who, and I think Chazal says because Hashem didn't want to say Lashon Hara. Yes, you're right, there are certain cases where we do describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu as doing things. A difficult topic also, yes. I agree that it's not entirely decisive. The Torah does sometimes command us to do things that otherwise would be usher. But, I'm not prepared with a complete resolution of what, when yes and when not.
Could you also argue here that the whole Isser is to not be hung with Hashem?
Right. Schwartz is suggesting that here, but it's not an Isser, like a Vodazara, it is a Vodazara, but Hashem says do it anyway. That would be problematic. But here, the whole Isser is don't go like Kaviyachal around Hashem's back and try to outsmart him by magic. But here, if Hashem is telling you, do this and I will give you the answer, the same way Nebuah is not considered the violation of Tamatiyah. Hashem tells you, or Betumim, or the same thing, anything Hashem sanctifies, you're getting information from Hashem. So Hashem authorizes the procedure. He gave us precedence in the Torah for Garo and tells you to use them. One could argue that that's not, one could argue that that is not a violation of Tamatiyah. So we'll just discuss now, historically, the use of Garelas by people to make decisions and whether it violates Tamatiyah. So there's a famous procedure known as a Garel HaGra. It's not clear why it is called a Garel HaGra. The basic idea predates the Gra. It's not clear whether the Gra had any connection to this procedure. It's not clear why it was ever associated with the Gra. Basically involves taking a Chumash or a Tanakh and somehow randomly, or apparently randomly, flipping and arriving at a certain pasuk and then inferring. You have some question, you have some decision or some question that you have, and you flip through and you find a pasuk and you use that pasuk to gain insight about what the correct course of action is, either what the future will bring or what the right thing to do is. In English, they call this bibliomancy, the magic involving books. It's a common procedure in other cultures too, not using the Bible necessarily, but it's an old idea. And in Jewish history, we have records of this at least going back a few hundred years. Some posts have suggested that the Makar actually is in the Gemara. The Gemara has an idea. The Gemara never discusses actual books, as far as I know, but the Gemara has an anecdote in several places. A Tana or an Amara would turn to a child and would say, Sokli Tukacha, tell me a pasuk, tell me what you're learning. And the child would recite what pasuk he was learning, and the rabbi would then learn something about what he should do. The famous Agarata of the Korban in Mizakin. Because they asked the kid, tell me what pasuk you're learning, and made a decision about redeeming him. That could have been because the kid knew about the kid was a Talmud Chacham, but there are other Gemaras that imply that the Tanam and Amaran acted based on the pasuk that came out of the kid's mouth. But in any event, going back at least to the time of the Chida, perhaps earlier, we have records of different Gedolei Torah utilizing some kind of procedure. The early Echor of the Chida, the people he quotes, don't give much guidance as to how you do this. He just vaguely says they use the Torah to find the pasuk and to do things. Here's a number of interesting examples. They involve Rashi Tevis of words in pasuk and pulling out words and making decisions. But in a bunch of different curious examples of the Chidah, in the 20th century, there are four or five famous stories of people doing Garo HaGra. I don't know if any of them are fully reliable. There is one they tell about Rav Aaron Cutler, after World War II, after the Holocaust, when he was leaving Europe, he was unsure of whether to go to Israel or the United States, and he did some kind of Garo HaGra procedure. And he arrived at the pasuk Leich Likras Moshe Hamidbar. Go to Moshe, which is understood to mean Moshe Feinstein, the leading Torah scholar in America. Hamidbar, America was a Midbar, unlike Eretz Yisrael. He understood that to mean go to America and help develop Torah, which he of course did, like with his other works, and develop Torah in America. In the Dati Lumi community, they tell the story about Rav Shaul Yisraeli, the great Talmud Chacham dying in Eretz Yisrael. story they tell about him was he was a young Torah student in Soviet Union after the fall of the Iron Curtain, and it was difficult to learn Torah in Soviet Russia. He was considering emigrating to Eretz Israel. The problem was he couldn't get legal permission to do so, and it was very dangerous to smuggle himself out. So he and one or two friends went to a very distinguished Muscovite Rav, a rabbi named Yaakov Klemis, and I don't know much about him, but he was apparently a very distinguished Talmid Chacham in Moscow. And I asked him, should we do this? Should we risk our lives to escape Soviet Russia so we can be Jews and study Torah properly in Eretz Israel? So he did some kind of Dara Lagra, and they arrived at a pasuk in Exodus Pasha in Dvarim. It says something about the bull. It says Ba'avar this, and you go there, and you go there, and you end up in Eretz Israel. So he took that as a sign that he should indeed go to Eretz Israel, and he, sure enough, he took the risk, rolled the dice, made it safely to Eretz Israel, and became one of the greatest Talmid Chacham in Eretz Israel of that time. They tell a story about Rabbi Eliyahu Lapyan, similar story, and the most famous story of them all is probably the most extensively documented, is told about Rabbi Levine after the War of Independence. So there were various fallen Israeli soldiers who couldn't be identified. They eventually recovered the bodies. They didn't always know which body was which. In particular, one story was the famous Laman Hay. The streets named after them today. There were 35 heroic soldiers who had been sent to defend the Gush. Yeah, the Gush was under siege by the Arabs in 47 or 48, and the Israelis sent a relief convoy of 35 young men, largely I think Americans, foreigners, to relieve the Gush, and they were captured, ambushed by Arabs, they were massacred, they were killed. What happened to them? They were all killed. When they eventually recovered the bodies, 23 of them were able to identify, and the remaining 12, they didn't know who was who. They knew which 12 were missing. They had records of who was there and who was dead. But 12 of the bodies, they were unable to figure out who was who. The question just was how to mark the graves. It wasn't an earth-shattering question about Gunnar or anything, but the question was how to properly mark the graves. So according to the way Simcha Raz recounts the story in his biography of Arya Levine, they went to Rafi Pesach Frank, one of the greatest Gedolim in Eretz Israel. He told them that you have to do a Goral. They had that special procedure. Who should do it? So he said, people decided to go to Arya Levine. Rafi Pesach Frank, Arya Levine didn't want to do it. Rafi Pesach Frank pushed him to do it. And then he gives an extensive account of how they did it. First they said Tehillim. Then they had a special Tanakh printed in Amsterdam in 1701. And he goes through all the details, exactly how they did it, with candles and silence, very dramatic. And they went one by one, each of the 12 graves, and each one they flipped to a pasuk in Tanakh, describes how they did it. They flipped page sections and pages and columns, and they got the psukim. Each pasuk, sure enough, arrived at a pretty clear reference to one of the 12 missing people. They got a pasuk that says, mentioned from Yeshua about Binyamin, that was Benjamin Bogoslavsky. Another pasuk about Benyamini, was a man named Oded Benyamini, so on and so forth. They got psukim which were clearly referred to the 12 soldiers who were missing. So again, one issue discussed was Tamim Tiyah. The Shulchan Aruch Paskins are not allowed to do a Goral. So again, we discussed the difference between past and future. This is really a question of past. They wanted to figure out who the remains are. But one issue is Tamim Tiyah, and the answer many Paskins seem to say is that an exception to the rule of Tamim Tiyah is if you're using Torah. Perhaps like Rabbi Schwartz was saying, because you're not using, you're not going outside Torah. If you use Torah, it's like the Tolkien Hashem. So many Akronim who allow, who endorse the use of these kinds of Goral procedures seem to fail. The reason it doesn't violate Tamim Tiyah is because you're going through the Torah, you're not going through an external source.
Exactly, like Tamim Tiyah, what exactly does that?
So the words are just those four words, five words, Tamim Tiyah Im Hashem Elokecha. It's generally understood by Chazal and the Poskim to mean that, as I said earlier, broadly speaking, it seems to mean that you shouldn't try to access information which you shouldn't have access to under the normal way of the world. As I said earlier, I think that it's generally not understood to bar the use of scientific methodology, the past or the future, but generally it is good to involve supernatural or non-rational, non-unnatural ways of obtaining information. You shouldn't be doing that.
Is the mainstream opinion that you're allowed to go just to see who the winner is? Or is that...
You mean if you want to bet on a football game? You mean just decide who should get the Kaddish, who should get... So as I said, there was a very long-standing tradition of Jewish communities to use Goral for, let's say, for Kaddishes and Shul. Similarly, Goral does have certain places, like the Gunim, for example, the Shul we started with, the Gunim did say that they used the Goral to divide property. The Poskim do occasionally endorse the use of a Goral for such procedures. Now, it's interesting, some of the sources, we'll get to this maybe a little bit soon, some of the sources point out, on the contrary, we find the Chazal, when they had questions of Safek or how to divide things up, Chazal usually tried very hard not to do a Goral. So the Chazal provided us with all kinds of other procedures. When you learn Bava Tzia, when you learn different sugyos in Kashrut Mishpat, Chazal, sometimes we say Matzvot Ol Harayim, sometimes we say Yachlok, sometimes we say Yimei Chashav Elio, sometimes we say Shu Dizadayim. Chazal have all kinds of different procedures. So there's another Gemara in Sanhedrin. Gemara says when you have two wagons or two camels or two ships that are passing and one has to give way, it's only wide enough for one. So what do you do? So the Gemara gives also a bunch of rules. If one of them is closer to its home port, he should move out of the way. If one of them is heavier, he should have the right of way. So the Gemara gives all kinds of rules. The Gemara does not simply say do a Goral. So some posts can indeed try to infer from this that a Goral is not generally the appropriate procedure yet. We saw in Kavasar, we saw in the Gun. There is ample evidence that Goral was used occasionally and accepted by different rabbanim as being a legitimate method for dividing properly. And I think the consensus is, so for example, Chaim David Halevi also in his tshuva discusses some of these objections, but he also says, even though it's not divine, he says, it doesn't go as far as the Kavasar, it doesn't have divine sanction, he says. On the other hand, there's no issue involved, there's nothing wrong, and as long as the people, it's not a halakhically mandated procedure, generally, he says, but as long as the people involved agree to resolve their dispute by this game of chance, that's okay. So if the people want to divide the property by Goral, I think the strong consensus of the post community is that's fine. Again, you mentioned the question of gambling and asmachta, that's a whole separate sugya, but assuming those problems are avoided, the consensus view, I think, is that simple questions of division of property, they would be allowed to use the Goral, at least if they all agree, if they all accept that that's what they're going to do with that, they'll make their decision. I mean, there's some element of, or something like poker, there's some element of skill, of out-guessing your opponent, or out-thinking your opponent. There's also some element of chance. So again, if we discuss asmachta, that becomes a whole other question. If we discuss Goral, would you say because there's an element of choice, of skill on the participants, not a Goral, or would you say since at the end of the day there still is a largely an element of luck, it is Goral? Interesting question. Not sure what to say offhand.
Did we just say that Goral's okay anyway? For those kind, for rock, paper, scissors is just a way of getting to a winner, so isn't that already, even if it is a Goral, should be okay?
Yeah. According to the, I think what the contentious view is, a Goral is mutter, regardless of whether you look at it as skill or as Goral, probably mutter either way. I think it should be fine. Putting aside any question of gambling or asmachta, I think it's probably fine. It would be an interesting question to figure out which category it falls into. So the last thing I want to discuss is one other point, actually, before we move on, is that one other objection to the Goral Hagra raised, and God talks about it, some poskim, is that Chazal in general did not like the idea of using the Torah for mundane purposes. For people shouldn't, sometimes it's considered vulgar to use the Torah for kind of, instead of studying and honoring it, to use it as a tool for your daily life. So there are poskim who raise the possible objection that using a chumash to decide what to do is degrading to the Torah. Again, there is this pretty strong tradition, both in modern times, if you believe these stories, as well as Chidah, an earlier rabbi who did use it, and Chidah actually says that he acknowledges this point. He says, nevertheless, it is mutter, at least in his opinion, it is mutter, and it's not considered a degrading use of the Torah. I guess you're honoring the Torah by showing that you consider it the source of wisdom and a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not considered a degrading use of the Torah.
I'm sorry. I don't think you feel good.
That's true. That is true. Most of the examples, I'm not going to have it right. Most of the examples of the Torah, the modern day examples we gave, they weren't just frivolous things. They were life and death. They were escaping Moscow to study Torah, to where of Aaron Kamish found his yeshiva. Most of these were A, very important, and B, were matters of religious significance too, of very important. C, were religious. Yes, that could be another argument. But Chidon himself, I didn't give his exact examples. Chidon himself, his examples are some of them are rather more mundane. But Alpha Peking, he says that at least in passing, it's not a problem of harnessing the Torah for a vulgar, mundane purpose.
In any case, Rabbi, using the Chumash is different than, it's not an absolute Gura, because you have to interpret, you have to do some reasoning on
right.
top of that.
That's true also.
It's not like throwing a dice.
That's true also, that there is some element of interpretation of your Torah, of your understanding of Torah. So, arguably, that could be a factor. I don't remember if anyone specifically introduces that, but that is an interesting point, right? Now, returning again, question that people raise about using the Garo for matters of life and death, which is obviously what they did in the case of Yona and other examples. So, we have a handful of interesting tshuvas, contemporary tshuvas, that discuss, relatively recent tshuvas, discussing the use of the Garo for matters of life and death. So, for example, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he's discussing what should a doctor, a physician, do if he has a conflict. He has two calls, both people are matters of life and death, and how does he know which one to take? So he says, first come, first serve, whichever call was received first he should take. Then he says, whichever's closer. And then he says, if there's no way to decide, if they're both equal, then he says, the Mishnah actually tells us a list of priority of certain people who've been saved before other people. If even that, he says, if that's not a deciding factor either, he doesn't know, he says, then Goro. He says, the doctor, in the final analysis, if he has no other method of resolving the deadlock, he performs a Goro, he plays God, he decides who's going to live and who dies by a Goro. And then, as I was talking earlier, there's a fascinating case in the Kinyan Torah B'Halacha. He says he had a case where there were 10 Jews who were studying Torah secretly in Leningrad against the law. And there was a raid. The communists raided their little Torah study group. And they had a secret cellar, a secret basement where they could hide. The problem was, unfortunately, the shelter was only big enough for 5 people. So they have to quickly decide which people would hide in the cellar and other people would be captured. They weren't going to be killed, he says. The penalty was not death. It was either going to be jail, I don't know how many years of jail, but jail or expulsion. You know, Siberia, I guess. And neither of these things were particularly attractive fates, but they weren't quite the same as death. So what they did, he says, they made a guard. Says this is in Leningrad, they hit in the cellar. They hit a girl, and the question was this the right thing to do? So he highlights this point that even he brings an earlier discussion in Poskim, which we'll get to soon, about Yona, about whether Halacha L'maisa would be allowed to do what Yona did in a case where the ship is sinking, the ship is foundering in a storm, whether you would be allowed to do a girl to decide who to throw overboard. As we discuss soon, there's a lot of discussion in that front of whether indeed that's mutter halacha l'maaseh or not. He says, our case is better for two reasons. First of all, he says, not life and death. Jail, as I'll say, that shivya, captivity, is sort of pikuach nefesh, but it's not really the same thing as actually taking somebody and throwing him overboard and killing him. Not really, not directly life and death, he says. And also, he says, here he says, the girl is who to save, not who to kill. In the case of Yona and the other cases, you're deciding who to kill. That's worse when you're deciding who to save. You're not killing anybody, you're just saying, I have a life preserver. You can be like throwing a life preserver. I have one, like in Moshe's case, I have one doctor, the doctor has one, can only treat one patient, I have one life preserver, who should I throw it to? That's better than actually deciding to throw somebody overboard. He goes back and forth, he discusses that. He comes out that the girl was the right thing to do, especially he said if you don't decide it'll lead to chaos and stampeding. He's inclined to say it's with her.
So we were opposed in the case of Yona, they should have had a girl to not be overboard. That would be better.
But I thought the decision there, I think practically speaking, even if you try to phrase it differently, I think the decision there ultimately really was who to throw. You're not doing anything. If you had a lifeboat, he says, Stephen talks about a case like Yonah. He says, if you have a lifeboat, just put somebody in the lifeboat and not throw overboard. But if the question was, like, you had one lifeboat and Titanic and not enough boats for people, if you're deciding who gets thrown into the lifeboat, that would be different. But if you're deciding who stays on board, who gets thrown over, I'm not sure if you really improve anything, but just...
Why does that make a difference as, who's the girl? Why should it make a difference whether you're deciding...
He's saying, for a practical matter, it's the same decision. So Alaka sometimes, though, works with these kinds of distinctions about whether you're... We can debate. I can understand both sides.
Maybe one reason is the whole question of whether you're allowed to go because of the element you play kind of playing God. So if you're deciding who's going to die, that's kind of playing God.
Right. His question, I think, is that in a practical matter, it's the same question. Whether, at the end of the day, he's living. Whether you phrase it like that or you phrase it like that, the result, the complete result, halakha sometimes doesn't work like that. Halakha sometimes works by the formal structure and how you phrase it, how you do it. I can hear both sides of the issue.
I mean, actively throwing someone over is different than...
Right, actively throwing someone over is different if you weren't going to do it, if you were just going to say... Right, if you just... Right. Halakha always distinguishes between a maisa and between a shei haltasa, which would be different. So, just quickly to run through some of the arguments. So, the basic question the poskim debate is whether what they did for Yonah was mutter, was the right thing to do, was a tila or not. The poskim go back and forth. The consensus of the poskim, Rav Avadya Yosef at length, says that in general, that's not that you're not allowed to do that, he says. Rav Avadya makes the point that they were anyway non-Jews, we don't make halakha for them, we discussed earlier, there are two sides to that. Chaim David Levy says they were good non-Jews, they were erelich, they were God-fearing, but self-go-self, even if you accept that, they weren't committed to Chabad, we have no reason to believe that these are questions where Gedolei Torah disagreed, and we have many svaras both ways. There's no reason to assume that a layman, no matter how well-meaning he is, would necessarily know the right conclusion. In any event, the Sefer Chassidim actually, Yehuda Chassid, talks about this question of what do you do in such a case of a ship that's foundering, you need to throw people overboard. He actually brings, he has a stira, he has two different passages where he seems to say both ways. To summarize, the consensus of the poskim strongly is that you do not do this, that we have no right to play God. Certainly, like Rabbi Schwartz was saying, to throw somebody over, be a dayan, we can't do. And the fact that Yonah did it, aside from the fact that they didn't see Yonah, aside from the fact that they were non-Jews, poskim make a number of other points. They say, first of all, the Medrash says that there were other things or other circumstances that very clearly indicated that something was wrong here. They say all the other ships were sailing calmly and peacefully. Dafka, this ship, was having trouble. It was clearly Minash Shemayim. Medrash says that they took Yonah, they dipped him in up to his ankles, the storm stopped, they pulled him back in, the storm started again, they dipped him in up to his knees, the storm stopped, they pulled him out, the storm started again, they dipped him in up to his waist and back and forth. And they did all kinds of experiments, and it was very clearly Siyata Dishmaya, it was very clearly the will of God that he was the one who had to be thrown over. Moreover, they said, Yonah himself was a Navi. The whole reason he was running away was he was a Navi. And he said, it is me, I'm a Navi, Hashem told me to do this, this is what's happening. A Navi can be trusted to tell you that what's happening, what's the will of Hashem. Some posts can go even further and say, wants to distinguish between whether the person agrees to follow the girl and be thrown over or not. To do a girl against his will is different from doing a girl with his will. Some posts can say there's no such difference because the person has no right to give up his own life if he wants to. But in any event, all these different svaras, they may not have been right in the first place, they weren't really common. Yonah was a Navi, Yonah agreed to this, they had evidence from the other ships, they had evidence from Yonah himself dipping him in. For all these different reasons, the poskim generally, the strong consensus of the poskim is that we have no right to make life and death decisions, again, actively. To save somebody's life is different, jail might be different, the case of the doctor is saving rather than killing is different, but to actively throw somebody overboard, to actively kill somebody based on a girl, there's a pretty strong consensus you can't do it. There is one exception, there are one or two exceptions, but overall, the consensus seems to be that we should not play God, we should not actively toss people overboard based on a girl, no matter how much divine sanction you might think a girl generally has. To go that far, to toss somebody into the ocean based on a girl, posts can generally assume that you should not do it.